Hello,
thank you so much for listening to the Anxiety Rx podcast.
I am your host, Dr. Russell Kennedy.
I created this show because I don't want you to have to suffer with anxiety the way that I did. And I truly wish I'd known this stuff 30 years ago. It would have changed everything for me.
And my
for more support,
is
please
Dimitrios
explore my
best selling
book, Anxiety Rx,
saying your name
right, or my very affordable online program, Anxiety Rx.
He is
remember,
a psychiatrist.
All anxiety is separation
Cleveland,
anxiety.
And he specializes in anxiety and overachievers, which is kind
of
like.
Keep
me,
holding on to that
so
part of you that
basically
hurts.
Pick his brain for the whole time about how to help myself. And then welcome, Dimitrios. Do I call you Dimitri for short or what?
You can call me Dimitri. That's fine. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know?
Okay.
And but just Dimitri, want to say like, thank you for the opportunity to be on your podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I like your stuff. I've watched your stuff for a while. So lots of people sort of ask, hey, can I be in your podcast? It's like, oh, I see, you know, there's people that I just appeal to. And I know in the 5 minutes we talked before we went on air, this is going to be a great conversation. Yeah. So, you know, physician burnout's a huge thing. Anxiety and overachievers. You say that a lot of your patients are doctors, which makes perfect sense to me, you know. And it's just trying to sort of in this world that we're so determined to get somewhere, like we're always trying to that left hemisphere, you know, that analytical, logical, linear, like, okay, you've got to, and if you're smart and you work hard, yeah, you can become a doctor, but what then?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we live in a society that's obsessed with achievement, you know, and if you go on social media for like 2 minutes, everyone's saying do more, be more, achieve more. And you can see how like you have this perception of like being behind your peers. Mm. So like you join this race, this hamster wheel that like leads to like ultimately burnout and difficulties with anxiety. And what's more concerning too is that we become so obsessed with achievement, like this need to achieve, that like we're putting all our happiness on that one basket. Right. And then like it's coming, like we're prioritizing it over other things like relationship with loved ones, our mental health, our happiness. So I think what we need to do as a society is kind of recalibrate our relationship with achievement.
Totally. You know, I read something the other day. I was like, every day I kind of read PubMed for the different studies. Like I'm fascinated with the default mode network and how impacts anxiety. And I read something called affective prediction error, which is basically the dopaminergic response to I'll be happy when.
When.
So when I get this, I'll be happy. And the prediction error is that no, you're not that much happier getting the thing. And in fact, you know, you get on this hedonic treadmill where you get so used to using negative energy to fuel you that the cortisol comes up and everything comes up to fuel you. And then when you get the thing, because cortisol blunts dopamine quite significantly, it doesn't feel as good.
Yeah, you nailed it. And we call that like the impact bias for like the audience. So it's like we overestimate the positive impact that like that achievement will have on our future happiness, right? We overestimate the duration and the intensity of how success positively impacts happiness. And what I tell people is that, you know, it's not always sunny with clear blue skies when you make it to the top of your mountain. There'll be plenty of days that are overcast with strong winds and heavy rains, right? Because, you know, we idealize achievement. We idealize becoming a doctor, a lawyer, you know, accumulating wealth, whatever our goal is. And we forget that it comes with its own baggage, its own challenges, right? Like you're going to be under more scrutiny. If you're successful, you're going to have more responsibilities, more expectations. More people are going to come knocking on your door with an ask, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think we do that for like a survival purpose too. Like the job of the brain is not to make us happy. It's to help us survive. Mm. So if you idealize success, if you idealize achievement, then you are more likely to go pursue your goals, right?
Right.
So I think because of that, we tend to idealize achievement and we fall for the traps that you said, like the arrival fallacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that affective prediction error just stuck with me for days after that. Because I remember when I got my medical degree and in my early 20s, it was like, this is all I wanted to be, was be a doctor. And then I got the parchment paper in my hand. Like that day, I was on the stage, I had the gowns on, all that kind of stuff. And as that parchment paper hit my hand, and I still have the paper on the wall, it was like, what's next?
Yeah,
I've been working for this thing for 10 years. And as soon as the paper hits my hand, I was like, okay, what's next? What's next? And that's kind of a little bit of my like ADHD personality as well, you know, which, you know, how many physicians do you think have ADHD?
That's a great question. I don't know. I know that physicians suffer at higher rates of mental health difficulties compared to the general population. Sure. About 25% have difficulties with anxiety, about 20% difficulties with depression, about 50 to 60% difficulties with burnout. I don't know about the ADHD. That's a good question. Yeah. But yeah, you know, like we work so hard to achieve a goal, yeah, right? Whatever that is, yep, earn a degree, get a house, get married, have kids. And then we achieve that goal. And how long does that satisfaction last? A week, maybe two. And then we're back at it just chasing more.
I remember when I got the advance for my second book. And the advance for my second book was three times the salary I made as a physician in one year. And I was happy for about 3 weeks. I was like buying stuff. You know, it was like, I made it. And I had this feeling like there's this thing called the recency bias in neuroscience, yeah, which is how you feel now is how you're going to feel forever. So I'm thinking, I got it made now. Like this is, I want easy street. And I remember thinking at the end of the third week, it's like, oh, there's this thing coming up. And that was the first time in about 3 weeks that anything kind of negative was allowed to actually have some real estate in my head. And that was a real watershed moment for me. It's like, no matter how much you achieve, you're always just, you know, it's the old saying, yeah, like, no matter where you go, there you are.
Yeah, I agree. So what I try to teach people is to have a healthy relationship with achievement, to have realistic expectations of the impact that achievement will have on them. Because the greatest tragedy is to like devote a decade of your life to achieve whatever the goal is,
right,
earn a degree, get a house, get married, get your dream job, and then be unhappy after you've made it to the end of your journey, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what we need to do is have other sources of meaning and purpose in our lives that are beyond achievement, like relationships, right? Like doing work that is meaningful, that makes a positive impact in society, right? Like practicing gratitude, cultivating our spiritual beliefs, whatever those are. I just think there are other sources of happiness that we sacrifice because we get very myopic in our pursuit of individual goals.
Yeah, and I think we need to be myopic on some level because we need to be focused on that goal. Mm-hmm. Like you can't sort of, you know, fall back into becoming a doctor or a psychiatrist. Like it takes a consistent, and there's days where it's like, I don't want to freaking do this, right? Like,
yeah.
But I think there is what drives us. It's like, oh, well, when I get this thing, and it's like, how much of that thing is actually that thing and how much of it, and I notice this a lot of my sort of high achieving colleagues, how much of it is just the challenge of it, like the Mount, yeah, I call it the Mount Everest of it. How much of it is the Mount Everest of it as opposed to actually like you're going to really enjoy this thing when you get it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we all have a need for personal growth, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we have these emotional needs and these needs govern our thinking and our behaving, right? The need for connection, the need for safety. One of the needs that we have is a need for growth. We always need to be working towards something. So that's important. But again, I think also that we need to kind of take a step back and try to be diversified and well-rounded. So you want to achieve a goal, go for it. You know, write a book, get your career, your dream job, earn that degree, you know, build your family, whatever that is. But I also think that we need to have multiple sources of happiness, right? Mm-hmm. We need to like continue to cultivate relationships because connection plays a vital role in mental health. We need to practice our self-care, right? We need to be, I think, well-rounded. And I think that is important so we don't fall for that trap of just like being so achievement oriented that we're, yeah, sacrificing everything else at the altar of achievement. But yeah, you're right. Like we do have that need for growth and the journey is probably just as satisfying, if not more than the actual destination.
Yeah. And you mentioned something earlier on too, and not directly, but you know, what I've noticed as I get older, like I'm 60, I'll be 65 this year. So it's kind of like, what is important? This sounds so cliche, right? It sounds so cliche, but what is important and what can you stay in the enjoyment of something? I know my wife and I last week were over in Vancouver and went to the Capilano Suspension Bridge, which is quite this, wow, you know, amazing kind of feat of nature, right? And I remember staying in it and going, oh, how long are we going to be here? You know, then we got dinner at this time or whatever. And then I said, okay, well, I'm going to set my timer for 5 minutes. And for this five mm-hmm. minutes, and I said to Cynthia, I said, for this 5 minutes, all I'm going to do is just look at the green of the trees. I'm not mm-hmm. going to do anything else. I'm just going to sort of sit there with that. And at the end of the 5 minutes, I was almost a little bit sleepy because I was so not used to like being in this sort of relaxed state. I really enjoyed it. It's like, well, it's the old thing about why don't I do this more often? But it was just funny how just it's not something we think of automatically.
Yeah. Yeah. You know how like, you know, achievement is very sympathetic nervous system, mm-hmm. right? Like you're always pushing yourself and you're on and you're going and you're focusing and you're using up a lot of cortisol, a lot of energy to achieve those goals. And again, it's part of the functioning of the brain. Its job isn't to make us happy. Its job is to help us survive. Right. And partially it does that by keeping us dissatisfied and always looking for that next thing. But, you know, what you're describing there is you being mindful and you being present and you activating your parasympathetic yeah. nervous system, rest and digest yeah. right? And you calm down there, right? And that must have been a nice feeling, I would imagine.
Not initially. It took a while because I'm used to running on this sort of kind of high octane. Look at this, yeah. look at this. Oh, this could be a post. Oh, what about this? So there was this sense that initially there was a bit of a rough patch going into it. But I've done it so many times, like with meditation and stuff, that like mm-hmm. I know that if I just sort of stay with it, I'll be fine, which is what happened. So after about a minute of my brain kind of squawking at me,
yeah.
I was like, okay, we'll let you go for a while. And it was just, so what my focus was, stay with the green, because everything yeah. was so green, right? So stay with the green. And that was a really good focus for me because I can't, it was everywhere and I could stay with it. And green is such a soothing color too. Mm. So that was something that really, and I used it later on in my meditation, actually. Can you imagine just looking at that tree or being up in that little treetop area and just sort of seeing that green that really made the impact on you? And I think that, you know, when we recall stuff like this from our past, it shows this, that we are safe, because a lot of us anxious mm-hmm. people go from trauma to trauma to trauma,
oh,
real,
sure.
real or imagined, right?
Yeah.
So just having that sense of safety and then just sort of being a somatic experiencing practitioner as I am and my wife is, we're always sort of saying, okay, that's the safety. Like, can you stay with the safety? And so many of my anxious patients, safety wasn't something that they had as their childhood. So it's an unfamiliar place.
Yeah.
The go, go, go was always familiar for them so that they can revert back to that, but it exhausts you.
Yeah.
So we just try and say, you know, little moments of safety and stick with it. How does that feel? Like, how does it? So I often have this little mantra that I call, that I say, sensation without explanation. So it's just allow yourself to feel the, even if it's painful, even if it's old trauma, like, can you allow yourself just to be in sensation with it? Without having to go up into your head. Because I think if we can stay with a sensation, we can learn how to acclimatize to it so it doesn't scare us anymore and it doesn't automatically knee-jerk us up into our head all the time to try and save ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with everything that you said. You know, there's comfort in the familiar, mm-hmm. right? Even if the familiar is physically and emotionally challenging,
yes.
right? So, you know, go, 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 achieving. One can argue that for many, it can be a trauma response, right?
Yeah.
If you are a young kid and you get a C on an exam and your father or mother punishes you, well, what do? Hey, you learn to achieve to satisfy and keep mom and dad happy, right? Mm. So it's amazing how parental figures and how the educational system reinforce this need to achieve from a really young age in us,
oh, yeah.
right? Like from a young age, we figure out, how should I act to avoid pain and to obtain validation, right?
Yeah.
So it makes sense that like we're always on the go because it's familiar, it's a safety response. And then your brain gave you permission to put your guard down and just not carry that yeah. shield for even a minute.
Yeah.
And that was like, you can finally catch your breath and let go. And you were finally, you gave yourself permission to just be tired in that moment.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to add is how nature invites us to be mindful.
Right.
it invites us to be present. Like there's something majestic about nature, be it the ocean, be it the forest, be it trees, water, whatever that is. And it kind of reminds us of our place in this world and universe, right? So one way for us to kind of be mindful and like have a healthy relationship with achievement is just even just going outside for 5 minutes and just taking some deep breaths and having those somatic experiences that you described, so we're not always on the go.
Yeah. And I think there is something, if you look at the brain, I think when we get into anxiety, depression, there's a part of our brain called the default mode network. So posterior cingulate and angular gyrus, precuneus, and medial prefrontal cortex. So this, I believe, just forms this sort of reverberating loop. And it can be either, it can be positive or negative. Most of the time it's negative. So we get into this default mode network and the energy becomes very, very internal. We become very, very, you know, Daniel Siegel talks about the human resonance circuitry or the social engagement system, eye contact, tone of voice, prosody of voice, body language, facial expression. All that stuff gets lost when you go into this sort of internal default. And the other thing about the default mode network is that there's part of the default mode network called the posterior cingulate cortex, which is thought to be involved in self-referential thinking. Now, if you grew up in a traumatic environment, there's this old saying that says if you abuse, neglect, or abandon a child, the child doesn't stop loving the parent, they stop loving themselves. And then the voice starts, and that PCC becomes that internal critic, that inner critic, that negative voice becomes a part of your default mode network. So if you're falling into this, you know, I'm unworthy, I'm a negative person, you know, I can't do anything right 100 times a day, it's going to affect your worldview.
Yeah, 100%.
So what I'm saying is that we get trapped in that default mode network, that very internal self-referential kind of thought. So anything we can move outward kind of just gives us a little bit of a respite from that.
Yeah, but it all makes sense from childhood, right?
Like, oh, yeah.
If mom or dad are upset at you and you depend on them for survival and, you know, you put them on a pedestal, well, therefore, there must be something wrong with me. Like, I upset mom, I upset dad, therefore, I need to work harder, do more, achieve more, behave differently in order to avoid that kind of a reaction in the future. So as a child, you know, you're 3, 4, 5, 6, I mean, you're always going to like – look up to mom and idealize them and love them. Therefore, there's something wrong with me. And, you know, you develop that thought process at a young age. It's really ingrained in that primitive part of our brain.
And that's the default mode. Yeah, that's the default mode. So if that's what you're, you know, the default mode is something I've talked to my listeners before about it, but basically they found something in the early 2000s, which was when people were doing these tasks in an MRI scanner, like mathematical tasks or, you know, describe a word or, you know, and what would happen is between these tasks, the brain would go into a very similar frame of activity with everyone. And they notice this, they call it the default mode network. So I'm a big believer in the default mode network has a huge amount to do with anxiety and depression too, but anxiety is kind of my jam. So when we get stuck in this default mode, And if you do grow up with trauma and you do tell yourself that you're not safe and you do tell yourself these negative things about yourself and you default into that, you know, a number of times a day, of course, it's going to affect how you feel in general. And then how you feel is going to direct how you think. And then this alarm anxiety loop just forms. And I think the thing about anxiety is a lot of people think that anxiety is all in your head. And basically, anxiety is two things. It's this alarm that's stuck in your body, sometimes from old trauma, and the anxieties of your mind. And each one aggravates the other, probably through the default mode network. So we need to understand that that's what's happening. And then when we understand that, how do I pull myself out of the default mode? Gratitude is one of the ways of doing it. And just how do I pull myself out of that and being outside? Yeah. How do I get out of this sort of negative, self-referential, like just hell that we're in?
Yeah. So I agree with everything that you said. And, you know, like, again, that impacts how we feel, how we think and how we act.
Yeah.
You know, part of that default mode is also like freezing, right?
Totally.
Shutting down, learn helplessness, right? So part of how we act is fight, flight, or freeze, right? Yep. So I agree with everything that you said. So how do we get out of that mode? I think we have to be very mindful, very intentional with that, you know? It can be, for example, going outside and being in nature that can promote mindfulness, right? It can be having a practice of meditation, like a mindfulness meditation practice for like even 5 minutes And I know it sounds like really hokey pokey, but, you know, just close your eyes in a quiet room for 5 minutes and focusing on the quality of one's breath by taking 4 seconds in and 8 seconds out, exhalation, sounds simple, but it's super hard to do. And every time your brain freaks out and it wants to take you away and you bring it back to just the breath, that's the bicep curl for the brain, right? I think also limiting technology, right?
Because this is the big thing now. Like this is massive.
Oh, it's huge, yeah. Right? Because like think about when you're online and you're seeing everyone else achieving, what does that do to that default mode? It probably activates and you're like,
totally.
Oh, I got to be doing more. I got to be doing more. I'm behind everyone else. And that triggers, that exacerbates one's need to achieve, right? So even limiting social media and just like limiting screen time, I think is essential. Here's a personal example. So I love going to Florida in the winter months because I live in Northeast Ohio, and you can appreciate how the winters can be challenging where we live.
Sure.
And I'm on the beach, you know, getting a nice jog. It's peaceful. It's quiet. And I made the mistake of checking my phone just to see what time it was. And I had a notification and I felt the anxiety increase. What do I do? Do I check my message? What if it's something important? What if, you know, now I got like 3 things to deal because of this message, right? So I was in this amazing place on the beach in Florida, spring break, you know, and just the checking of my phone took me away from nature. Right? It took me away from that moment. So again, limiting social media and technological exposure is important as well. And I think also practicing some gratitude. Again, doing these exercises that help us be mindful, be intentional, and have an integrated and holistic perspective on life.
Yeah, there's a part of our brain called the ACC, anterior cingulate cortex. And the anterior cingulate cortex kind of acts as the switch out of the default mode network.
Yeah.
Now, the weaker your ACC, the more likely you are to get stuck into social media and be stuck there for 45 minutes, you know, zombie scrolling and not be able to get out of it. I call the ACC kind of like the Goggins nucleus, you know, after David Goggins, because he, no matter what happens, he is so self-disciplined. He just sort of, nope, we're going to do this.
Yep.
So things that build up this ACC are gratitude. For one, it's been shown quite clearly that gratitude will build your ACC, which builds your ability to switch out of default mode. Meditation is another one. And then just doing hard things. I think this is kind of where cold plunges and that sort of stuff come in.
Yeah.
And I think cold plunges are really helpful for people with trauma too, because what cold plunges do is you go into the cold plunge and your body says, get the hell out of here. This is too painful.
Yeah.
So I think there is a correlate with trauma, because I do think we feel, you know, trauma in the body, trauma that's stored there, right? And it has a particular signature to it. In me, it's a fist shape, purple, crystalline density in my solar plexus. Now, if I go into this cold plunge and I stay there, even though it hurts, I feel better. I get this rush of endorphins. I feel better. And I think the analogy is, if we can stay with the trauma, if we can stay with that feeling, as long as it's not completely overwhelming, like I always, you know, warn people with emotional, physical, sexual abuse in their history, like this is often just too much of a powder keg to deal with. But for regular kind of traumas, if there is such a thing, it's like you're teaching yourself, I don't want to stay in this trauma, because usually what people do when they don't want to stay in the trauma is they go up and they start worrying. Right. Yeah. So if you can learn how to stay with the trauma, you don't have to worry anymore. And you can actually learn how to metabolize that alarm that's stuck in your system so that you're not a slave to thinking anymore. So I think that's one of the things I like about cold plunges is I think they help you build your ACC, because it's like, I don't want to go in there, but if I do it for me, what I have to do is I have to, before I do it, as I sort of put my hands together and I just make this intention for about 10 seconds that I'm going to go in, it's going to be uncomfortable, and I'm going to stay there. If I don't do that, I get in and almost within about 10 seconds, like I can't stand it. But if I do the prep, if I do that, like this is going to be uncomfortable, but I'm going to stay there. For some reason, I can easily kind of stay in there for like 30 seconds, 60 seconds, sometimes 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like the surrender, like the letting go.
Yeah.
Like the more you fight that pain, the worse it gets. But like just like the letting go and relaxing the body and slowing and slowing down the breathing system and the heart rate. And it makes it less painful because, again, the cold plunge is painful, yeah. You know, but then like when we activate our sympathetic nervous system, we add more pain to it. We make it more painful than it has to be.
Yeah.
Right. So like that fighting, that resistance just makes something tougher than it has to be. Going back to this idea of the trauma that you mentioned, I agree. It is physical, right? Mm-hmm. And what we try to do is, you know how like when it comes to like physical health, if you want to start running, you're not going to go run a marathon for the first time. You might like walk for 15 minutes, then jog for 5, and then maybe the next time you jog for 10. There's a gradual buildup that happens to achieve physical health mastery. Well, the same thing is true for like mental health mastery, right? It's about these gradual exposures at our pace, at a reasonable pace, at a safe pace that we feel like, okay, today I have 1% more mastery of this stressor, of this reminder of my past trauma. And then the next day, 1 additional percent, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes the brain likes to think all or nothing. I've either mastered something completely or I haven't. Oh. I'm going to run a marathon. I'm not going to sit on the couch. Again, the brain likes all or nothing, right? Mm-hmm. It looks for those kind of shortcuts. But what I tell people is like, let's get better by like 1%.
Right.
Whatever the goal is, physical, mental, spiritual, whatever the goal is that you're working towards. And again, 1% over a long period of time, that leads to tremendous positive changes.
And then you get some agency. Like that's what I find so difficult for people with anxiety. So what I would often do with people that have panic attacks, I would give them a couple of tablets of like lorazepam or oxazepam or Xanax or whatever it was. And I'd say, look, the next time you have a panic attack, take one of these, right? So they don't want to do it, but it's like, okay, I had a panic attack. I took it. And in 20 minutes, I was right as rain. Mm-hmm. So after that, all they really needed was to know that they had it in their pocket and they were fine.
Right.
It's like, you know, I get panic attacks. I know I've got it there. I can deal with it. It's just this feeling like I can't deal with this.
Yeah.
So when they have something, when you start building some agency, and this is what I do with most of my anxiety people, when they start seeing that, hey, I am actually the one that's in control of this. It's not in control of me. And I do this with panic attacks too. As I say to people, when you start getting a panic attack, tell yourself, and I'm going to swear here. It's like,
it's okay.
I'm going to make this the best fucking panic attack I've ever had. I am going to make this like, come on, like bring it on, panic attack. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of what happens with panic attacks is you push it back, you push it back, you push the ocean back, you push the ocean back, and then it just, you can't anymore. And it just hammers you. But when you sort of, you know, accept it and sort of take it in and accept like this is what's going to happen, you have the illusion of control. And the illusion of control in and of itself helps you with anxiety.
Yeah. No, I agree with everything that you said. You know, it's like people have anxiety about the anxiety.
Yes, totally.
They have anxiety about the future panic attack. And I understand. It's a terrifying experience. Mm-hmm. I've had many patients end up in the ER the first time they had a panic attack thinking that it was like a heart attack, right? And then you can imagine like, well, I had this experience that mimics a heart attack and they did all this blood work, all these troponins and everything's normal. And then the ER doc will say, well, it's all in your head, which is very stigmatizing, by the way.
Absolutely.
And you can imagine how that creates this feeling of terror and powerlessness, right? And one of the things I try to teach people is like, yes, how can we have agency? What are things that you can do to lower the impact of this panic attack so that you're not completely paralyzed by it? Because people are afraid, like, what if I fall down again? What if I get lightheaded? You know, what if I have another syncopal episode? What if I have this sensation in my chest, right? And I think once we have a level of agency over the whatever the experience is, it becomes anxiety reducing. I also want to add how powerlessness is a reminder of past traumatic experiences.
Totally.
Like if you think about what people have been through in their past, which was traumatic, abuse, physical, emotional, sexual, you can imagine there's a paralysis, there's a powerlessness. So then they might have a panic attack 30 years later about, you know, being at the barbershop, being at a crowded place, you know. But what happens is it's that feeling of powerlessness. It's not just about what is happening in 2025. It's also about, oh, that was the feeling that I had 20, 30 years ago. And it takes them back to a really difficult place. And they don't necessarily know that.
No.
But they know that feeling, that emotion of terror, of of paralysis, of powerlessness. And I think that also feeds the panic attack.
Yeah, because the amygdala has no sense of time, right? Yeah. So I will often say, I have a patient, I use this example a lot because I really like it. So I have this patient who was yelled at by her mother quite a bit when she was younger. Her mother was otherwise, you know, kind of connected and stuff. She wasn't a horrible mother, but she had this sort of quick temper and would yell at my patient. So she was in the grocery store and heard this mother yelling at her child. So immediately her amygdala picks up, central amygdala recognizes the same, this has happened in the past. And I think she had like a panic or a huge anxiety issue. And I think her body probably felt now, as a 38-year-old woman, the same as she felt when she was a 6-year-old little girl. The same thing. And I always say that all emotional overreactions are age regressions.
Yeah.
Because of the amygdala, it has no sense of time. So if it senses a similar thing, it will take you, your body, back into that exact same framework, which in which you were powerless at that time. Yeah. When you're 6 years old, you are powerless.
Yeah. I mean, that's the job of the amygdala. Mm-hmm. It doesn't know if a bear's running at you or if you're in a dangerous situation or you're stuck in traffic. It doesn't know. It just fires and activates the HPA axis. Yep. Hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. It just, there's a bunch of cortisol in your bloodstream and it's just doing its job trying to protect you.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It doesn't know what the stimulus is.
You remind me of a great little story that I haven't told on the podcast for a while, but it's basically when you're on a hike and you round a corner and there's a stick sticking out of the ground that looks like a snake. Right. So immediately the down and dirty pathway goes through the amygdala. This is something you jump back from. That's the limbic pathway. The cortical pathway of fear goes, oh, this is just a stick.
Yeah.
So it's like, if we have both of them active at the same time, if it was a snake, the cortical pathway would say, this is a snake. And the limbic pathway would say, yes, get the hell out of here. But the fact that there's two parallel processing, one is immediate. And the other one is kind of like, hey, you know, like fast and slow. So it's really interesting to see how we have these two parallel pathways. We can use the cortical pathway to kind of override the intense kind of physical pathway.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's too strong, doesn't matter how strong the cortical is. Like if you had a snake phobia and you came around and you saw that stick, you may not be able to settle down for 20 or 30 minutes because your system is so potentiated and primed for that. But in general, we have these two parallel pathways. And this is why people say, you know, when I hear people say that all stress comes from a thought, it's like, no, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. In that case, the stress came from the HPA axis. It came from the down and dirty pathway saying, this is a fearful situation. It wasn't until the thought came that, okay, this is just a stick, that you knew you were okay. But all stress does not come from a thought. There's a feeling.
No, I agree with you totally.
Yeah.
And you can't outthink a physical symptom. Like if your heart's racing and you're short of breath and your muscles are tense and you have a pounding headache, you can't just outthink that.
You can't outthink a physical symptom.
Right. But you can't, right?
Yeah.
So you need to like have the awareness like, oh, my heart's pounding. I'm short of breath. My muscles, my shoulders are shrugged to my ears. Mm. Let me engage in these somatic experiences to activate my parasympathetic nervous system. Let me do my deep breathing, cold water, cold air. Let me slow down. And once you've gained control of the body, then you can engage in that higher order thinking. But first you got to like control the body.
Totally. That's exactly what I write about in my book. I have this sort of ABC process. So A is awareness, like how this, I'm aware of this bodily sensation. I've had it thousands of times before. I know what it's like. Okay. Body and breath. There's no point in that point when you are stressed to start trying to calm yourself down, like saying, hey, relax. Doesn't work. You got to go in through your body first. Physiological sigh is amazing. Two quick sniffs in and then long, slow exhale out. So you go to your body first. And then the last one, the C, is like the compassionate connection typically to the child in you, because it's the amygdala. It's the child in you that's going through this reactivation. It's not adult you. The child is kind of inside of you reactivating the same old trauma, the same old powerlessness that you had when you were 8 years old. So you've got to do the awareness first, be able to see it. This is your ACC. It's like, oh, I'm in this trauma response. I'm in this emotional response. Been here before. I now have to go into my body. I can't stay in my head, even though it's so seductive to kind of, you know, as you said, try and talk your way out of a physical symptom. It's so seductive because we're such a left hemisphere thought driven society. But it's the exact opposite because it's only going to make it worse. It's only going to delay the fact that your body is activated. And as your body gets activated, you lose the prefrontal cortex. So you lose the ability to kind of go, hey, we have to become aware here. So yeah. I totally agree with you is we have to go to the body first. Once we ground ourselves in the body, then come back to the thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And emotions are physical. People don't realize totally. Like emotions are physical. Like when we're angry, as an example. There are physical changes to the body. Your heart's pounding. Your muscles are tense. Your vein's going to explode. Yeah. It's going to bulge, right? You're turning red in your body. You're clenching your teeth. Like, emotions, anxiety, anger, sadness, grief, they're physical. We feel them in our gut, in our chest, in our neck, right? So I agree with you. It's like first we gain control of the body. We have to like – dampen that sympathetic nervous system reaction, which is physical. And once we've done that, then we have the space and we feel safe enough to be able to engage in that high order thinking.
And then you learn that. Otherwise, you just keep repeating the same pathway over and over and over again, which is what most people do that have, you know, chronic anxiety or depression. It's such an ingrained pathway. And it's, you know, it's the Freudian repetition compulsion, you know, what was familiar to you in childhood, you will unconsciously replicate in adulthood. I had patients who, because I was a family doctor, so I would see family patterns, you know, of alcoholism and then picking alcoholic partners, you know, these women who grew up with alcoholic parents would pick alcoholic partners and they knew cognitively, it's like, I'm making a mistake here on some level. But the drive was so powerful to reproduce, as you say, the familiarity. Like we reproduce, we equate familiarity with security as human beings. So whatever was familiar to you as a child, you will unconsciously kind of go back to that unless you're aware enough to see, hey, I don't want to do things this way anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's also an attempt to master the past. You know, sometimes we can't master our past because mom and dad suffered from alcoholism. Mm. They were abusive. You know, maybe dad was a narcissist. You know, so then like we find a person who's similar to them, as Freud said, repetition compulsion, because we're trying to master that past. Like if I do it right now, I have finally conquered that mountain. You know,
it's a great point.
But it's a mistake to do because what typically happens is like the same outcome, right? We tend to repeat our presence instead of master.
Sometimes I know that people have to go through that. They have to actually go in and pick the wrong partner. Yeah. Maybe three or four times before they finally go, look, I'm not doing this anymore. Yeah. I can't do it anymore. But that pull is so strong. You know, that pull is so strong to reproduce in that childhood, you know, template. The pull is and I think we were talking about this before we went on air. And I think a lot of doctors have this kind of thing is that, you know, they were people pleasers. They were kind of like the support network for their parents. They were rewarded for that on some level. Oh, you're my little helper. You're so good at this. And nurses do this too, for sure, is we get into this thing. Well, we go into the helping professions because when we were children, if parents weren't safe, we weren't safe. So we tried to make the parent feel safe and become a parent to them. We got imbued by that. On some level, because you're so grown up, you're so wise beyond your years, but we lose the ability to read ourselves in that situation, and then we wind up burning out because it's like this isn't the rewarding thing that I was kind of hoping for in my Freudian repetition compulsion childhood.
Yeah, that is so true, and like part of also what happens is that as physicians, we learn at a young age that if you achieve. Mom and dad are happy with you. Right. They're pleased. They validate you. Whereas if you fail to meet their expectations, you're punished, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a super high need to achieve from a young age. And, you know, it takes a certain personality to say, you know what, I'm going to extend my studies for 7 to 10 years after college and take on six figures in student loans.
Sure.
Like you need a certain wiring.
I think so.
Right?
Well, I say that to people, you have to have a bit of a nut loose to become a doctor. I think you do.
Right? You know? You do. You need to be a perfectionist. Yeah. You need to be very achievement oriented. You need to be altruistic. And then you enter this field called medicine that selects for and reinforces different traits.
Totally.
Right? You got to be obedient and fit the culture. You need to be a perfectionist. You need to be self-reliant. You need to self-sacrifice. And then like by the end of the journey, you've become a physician, but you have all these traits that make you more vulnerable to suffering.
Yeah, because you lose connection with yourself. You know, exactly. When you stay up, when you're doing 36-hour shifts, I remember doing the ICU and, you know, doing 36-hour shifts and you're exhausted, but you have to keep hammering away at this sort of thing over and over and over again. And you learn to sacrifice yourself and it becomes a learned behavior. So yeah. when you actually get a chance to sit on a beach in Florida, you can enjoy it because the part of you, like I had these patients when I was in my practice. They were Asian and they worked all the time. And they wound up making like four or five different businesses. And by the time that they retired at 60 or 65, they had tons of money. But they had no ability to enjoy it because they had been working. Their template was like work, 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 work all the time. And they couldn't relax. They couldn't enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, right? If you've spent the majority of your life working and yep. hustling to achieve whatever the goal is, earn a degree, save a bunch of money, build businesses, whatever that drive is. Eventually you get to the end of it and you're like, now what? And now you have a huge abyss and now you don't even know how to enjoy the freedom of having time or the resources that you accumulated all these years, right? Yep. So that's what I try to teach people is like, learn how to press pause, learn how to breathe, learn how to cope with the discomfort of having a little bit of idle time,
mm-hmm.
learn how to cope with like the guilt that you initially experiencing doing self-care, right?
Yeah.
Again, that's important to work on that part of you so that you are more than whatever your goal is, whatever your achievement is, whatever is driving you career-wise, financially.
Yeah, what you said earlier I think has such relevance here is that you have to do it slowly. You can't all of a sudden go from 100 miles an hour to sitting on a beach in Florida doing nothing. You have to have some way of kind of, you know, in somatic experience, we can call it the trauma vortex and the counter vortex. Trauma vortex is your old wounds that kind of keep up and keep you forced in a certain area. The counter vortex is like, okay, can I go into this place that I can stay with and just observe how I'm feeling? You know, I used to have this joke. I did stand up for 10 years. I don't know if you knew that, but I did stand up comedy for 10 years. And I used to have this joke about if you're poor and depressed, you got a reason. But if you're rich and depressed, you're screwed. Like you can't look back and go, oh, you know, I'm just depressed. It's like you have all this money. You have what society says, this is what you were supposed to get. And then you feel empty and you're like, I was told there'd be cake. You know, I was told something that didn't wind up being true for me. And I see a lot of people who are very successful, who are very anxious. And I guess you do too with most of your people.
Oh, totally. They're suffering behind a facade of achievement, you know. Doctors, lawyers, CEOs, I see so many who are suffering behind a facade of achievement. And there's a study I like to share with people is that there's a study of decamillionaires. And the majority – and they asked these decamillionaires to rate their happiness and if they believed they needed more money in order to be happier by one point on a 10-point scale. And the majority of decamillionaires, over 60% thought, yep, I'm not a 10 out of 10. I'm like maybe a 6 or a 7 and I still need more money to increase my happiness. Yeah. So like even at $10 million, there's studies out there, there's questionnaires and people still think, yep, I need more money. I'm not there yet.
Because I think if you look at operant conditioning, mm-hmm. when they hit that big thing, when they sold their IPO, whatever, when they made their $10 million or whatever, that's such a huge dopamine rush.
Sure.
And I see this with people too who do like ayahuasca or peyote or one of the powerful psychedelics, right?
Yeah.
And they have this amazing experience. And then you'll see these like hippies, you know, 40 years later that are still hanging out trying to do the psychedelics because they're chasing that one experience,
yeah,
right? And thinking, okay, that was the most important experience of my life or intense, and they keep trying to chase it. And it's like, no, it doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't work. Yeah. The first time is always the most intense. And then, you know, you get trapped in this thing of like, can I do this again? And you can, but then it becomes this huge disappointment. If something, here's the thing, you do something and it's a 10 out of 10 excitement for you. The next time you do the same thing, it's a 9 out of 10. That's a letdown. If you look at dopamine, if you look at reward prediction error, if you look at dopamine, that's actually a letdown.
Yeah. Yeah. And that chase of that 10 out of 10 is what leads to addiction.
Totally.
That first drink, that first high, that first buzz.
Totally.
That first $1 million, whatever the high is that led to that 10 out of 10, you can never recreate it.
Nope.
And that chase for that 10 out of 10, that's what leads to suffering.
Absolutely. So, you know, how long have you been a psychiatrist for?
I've been 15 years, including my training, over 15 years. Yeah.
Okay. So what do you find like works best? I mean, there's no one size fits all, of course, but what themes have you seen that have really helped with your anxious patients?
Yeah, I think talking about it, I know it sounds very cliche, but getting things off your chest. There's something about holding on to it that exacerbates the suffering. So like when you talk about it and put it out in the open, that is a release to some degree.
Yep.
And then to do that in a safe environment that's compassionate, that's empathetic, it takes away a lot of the stigma, because stigma and shame exacerbate the experience of anxiety, right?
Yep.
And I think once we have trust, once we have a healthy relationship that we can talk about what's making us anxious, once we're feeling validated, you're worried, you're concerned, it makes sense to me. I think that's the catalyst for doing the deeper work in order to, I guess, have some agency over our anxieties.
Yeah, it's kind of like gaining some confidence over too. I remember hearing this study that was done years ago about people that wanted to kill other people. They were so angry. But once they verbalized it, the urge to kill that person disappeared in the vast majority of them. And I often say that your thinking brain, your speaking brain, and your writing brain are three different brains.
Yep.
And this is where I think journaling comes from. This is where I think talking about it comes from. When you can sort of triangulate these things, when you can speak about it, when you can write about it, when you can think about it, you just sort of spread out the trauma into a bigger. It's like putting a drop of blue dye in a small glass of water or a big vat. You know, you just you're able to spread it out more. And I think as it gets spread out more, you see it more objectively.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see it more objectively, you go, huh, why did I get so upset about that? Like that wasn't such a big deal. But that's why I tell people, like, speaking brain, thinking brain, writing brain. So this is why I think writing about stuff that really bothers you, even if you just sort of stream of consciousness, just get it out. You know, it helps us sort of see things in a different way. The other thing that I found really helpful, especially with my men, is tears, you know, which isn't popular for sure.
But it's a release though, right?
Oh,
it's a release.
And it's adaptive too, because basically in our brains, you know, your dog still died, you're still getting a divorce, but there's something about tears that actually reframes it subjectively. So it's not as bad. And I think women have this, women know this, but men can't do it. So often what I will do with my men is I'll say, get in the car, go to a park that no one's around and just start screaming. And sometimes I get people to say, like, scream at your dad, scream at your mom. Yeah. And it's amazing how often men will find tears through frustration that they won't find through sadness. And how much anxiety is actually unresolved grief.
Oh, sure. I agree with everything that you said, right? The importance of releasing and how suppressing and repressing exacerbates the symptom. It exacerbates the feeling. It exacerbates the cognitive load associated with the past difficult life experience.
Point.
So these are all different forms of release, right?
Yeah.
Be it cry, be it screaming, be it exercising, be it running, be it talking about it, journaling. These are all different forms of releasing using different parts of the brain and the body.
Internet went out there. Hopefully he'll come back. Yeah, so your internet went out. Usually Riverside picks it up. But I think, you know, so what I will tell people is, the more of these things you can do, the more you kind of spread it out in the sort of star map of your mind. And the farther you can spread it out in the star map of your mind, the more likely you're going to be able to integrate it. You know, because anxiety, depression, it usually comes from a number of disparate parts that have learned to cope. They've learned a certain strategy to cope, but they're not helping you. So if you can start allowing these things to be in connection with each other, you kind of spread it out and give the brain an option to go, oh, I never looked at it that way. I never saw it that way before. Oh, this is coming up. Mm. Tears, these things. It kind of helps integrate these processes because, as you know, like trauma is expensive. It's like trauma therapy is very expensive, and it's trying to get as many people on track with stuff that they can do themselves because not everybody can afford to see us.
No, I agree with everything that you said, right? So the more tools that somebody can have in the arsenal to explore and process past life experiences and understand how they impact the here and now,
right.
I think the better equipped they are to cope with past life experiences, but also those that are triggers in the here and now. So yeah, it's about having a variety of tools of the mind and body to be able to navigate
and integrate those old wounds. Yeah. I think so much of it is integration. You know, Daniel Siegel talks about that too. It's just so much of it is like when we can get it in for take these disparate parts that have been sort of cobbled together in a coping strategy, worry being one of them and resistance being another one, to the point where you're, I can actually allow this to be in me. Like I can feel it. I don't like it, but I can feel it. I can allow it to be there. And then when you can allow it to be there, you're no longer a slave to it. You no longer have to immediately try to make yourself feel better. And usually what we do to make ourselves feel better is go into our heads and try to explain it. And I often say you can't think your way out of a feeling problem.
Yeah.
And but the brain will tell you it can. It does.
Yeah.
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 Anything you want to sort of, and we haven't touched on or whatever that you wanted to sort of bring up, because I'm going to let people know how to get a hold of you and that kind of stuff in a minute. But
just I really appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk about, you know, how we all have, you know, this need to achieve and how our relationship with achievement is associated with anxiety and even past life experiences, some of which are traumatic, right?
Sure.
And I'm glad that we had a chance to kind of talk about how to cultivate, work on having a healthy relationship with our achievement and how to work on mastering our different levels of anxiety that often stem from this excessive need to achieve.
So before we go, sort of what are your hints to people that are maybe wrapped up in that feeling like, oh, when I'll be happy when?
Yeah. Yeah. I try to remind them that, you know, we idealize success. It's, you know, it's not what it's going to be, you know, and what I tell them is to work on finding some happiness in the here and now, whatever, regardless of their circumstances, because if you don't know how to find happiness now, you'll have a hard time in the future. And you know what? If you're going through
things get worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if they get worse or better, but I will say that if you're able to find some happiness, some joy in your current state of living, even if things were to get better in the future, you will experience that much more happiness, right? Because it takes – and you have to be intentional to find happiness in life. Yeah. The reality is that your brain doesn't want you to be happy. It wants you to be anxious and it wants you to be dissatisfied because these are – this is how we survived as a species.
Right.
The job of the brain is not to make you happy. The job of the brain is to help you survive. I mean, if you look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, our ancestors come from very harsh conditions, right? So being dissatisfied, hey, I'm going to go get more resources to survive.
Right.
Being anxious, it protects you from predators, right? So because of that, we actually have to work on finding happiness in the here and now.
How do people find you?
So I'm on Instagram at Dr. Demetrius. I'll spell it out, D-I-M-I-T-R-I-O-S. So I'm on Instagram. I'm also on X or Twitter with the same handle at Dr. Demetrius. I write for Psychology Today.
I saw that.
So if they want to look up some of my writing. And I also just recently published a book called Physician Burnout, How to Rise Above a Broken Healthcare System as a Practicing Clinician. So for any physicians out there struggling with burnout, anxiety, and other emotional difficulties, I just published a book that I hope is helpful to them.
Yeah, it's such a great cause because – and it's trying to get physicians to buy into it too because we do have that Superman mentality, right? But I think the pressure is becoming so great that doctors are – they have to find something or else, yeah, you know, they have to get out. And there's very few jobs that will give us the same level of income and security and that kind of stuff as a physician. So physicians feel trapped. So if you're in a situation, find the information you need to be able to stay in that job as opposed to thinking, oh, you know, another 6 months, I'll be okay. I'll get this vacation coming up. It's like this, because I notice a lot of physicians that go, oh, well, I've got this coming up and I've got that coming up. It's no, no, no. It's today. As you were saying, if you don't feel it today, you're not going to feel it tomorrow. So yeah, thanks so much for joining me. It's a great episode.
Now, Dr. Russ, thanks for the opportunity to come onto your podcast. I had a blast talking to you.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much for listening to the Anxiety Rx podcast. I created this show because I don't want you to have to suffer with anxiety the way that I did. And I truly wish I'd known this stuff 30 years ago. It would have changed everything for me. For more support, please explore my best-selling book, Anxiety Rx, or my very affordable online program, MBRX. Remember, all anxiety is separation anxiety, and mostly separation from that hurt part of you. So keep holding on to that part of you that hurts, and I'll see you next time.